This is David Moore. We're going to do an interview with Bill Havert. This is going to be our fifth set of questions. It's April the 4th, 2016, and we're going to be talking about a little bit about the Cold War and also his golf business, as he was a golf professional in the years after the military. So, Bill, let me just get started. We'll talk about the Cold War, as you recall. You may remember when you were in the military, the majority of your time in the military was post-World War II, Korea and Vietnam, and then thereafter the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Just some thoughts you might have had on those years.
Well, what I remember mostly is that the whole of the U.S. almost went to war over the Cold War threat. Mm-hmm. I remember specifically the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of, I personally did not participate, but I have several friends who I knew later and even today moved with their unit to Florida to counter the Cuban Missile Crisis. So It was a very, very real and very obvious situation that I was.
Kind of tense for not only the military, but for
yes,
the whole nation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of, did you have confidence that President Kennedy could have staved off that problem, or how did you feel about the presidential administration and the government at the time?
I think early on, I had my doubts whether it could be done or not. But then I think the way it was handled and the way it turned out, it was effective in the efforts in which he did. So I think I had the confidence then even that he could pull it off.
Yeah. Okay.
Although I was not a Kennedy fan.
Is that right? Okay. Well, did you have... Can you recall anything from the viewpoint of the military that would have given some insight as to what y'all's status was, in preparing against the Soviets and that type of thing?
Well, yes, I have several friends today who were in units who moved the total unit to Florida or to the Gulf of Mexico coast in order to counter that problem. And so it disrupted the whole military operation worldwide to counter.
You're talking about on the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes, sir.
How about just the Cold War in general, after this, like going from the 60s and then on into the 70s, did you find that was something that was constantly on your mind, constantly on the planning, and constantly on the forefront of military training and preparation and that sort
yes,
of thing?
Yes, in fact, some of the commands within the Air Force did their whole training program around the Cold War threat. For example, the Strategic Air Command with the B-52 bombers and the missile crisis and the missiles that were in, the people were standing alert for the missile silo operation and also the B-52, and that's where in-flight refueling came along and was very, very important because we put an aircraft overhead all the time and it had to be refueled air. And so I have several friends that were in that business as well. Uh-huh. So I'd say across the board in the military were disrupted totally to counter the Cold War threat.
I see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
David, I have a little fold-up table that'll fit right there.
Oh, this is fine. This is fine.
Yeah, or you could use Bill's laptop.
Well, this thing is doing great. I use this quite a bit. It actually works pretty good because it's smaller.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Well, let me see. What was our next question was... obviously the Cold War had a lot to do with the nuclear threat and the possibility of us getting into a back and forth with Russia, the condition of The condition of the threat of nuclear war was a constant issue that we had. I even remember as a child doing practices, you know, as a school child, what would happen if, you know, we had a nuclear bomb hit us and that sort of thing. So that was definitely something that that kept us thinking about it. But I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the nuclear threat in those days. It seemed like it was more of a concern, more on the forefront of our thinking than it was, I mean, back then than it is now.
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think you saw it, like you say, in schools, in daycare centers, the whole thing to take care of the children as best we can. That was one of the striving points, is to make sure that that's all taken care of. Other than that, except for the frustration of having to stand alert and do things that might not normally have been done except for this Cold War threat, that's the only thing that bothered me, is just why do they have to go to this extreme as Crete and all this be gone? I remember you find some tanker people in the Strategic Air Command, they might be gone for a week at a time, standing alert somewhere in the air, so that they can pick up that bomber as he comes overhead on the way to the Soviets to counter.
Yeah, I noticed one of the notes that you put on there had to do with it being, you really worried more of it being an accidental or some type of
knowing what happens and when you get a group of people that maybe not the most qualified, most up to speed, up to date event. I was very fearful of accidental detonation.
Man. Rather than a...
intentional.
Yeah, rather than an intentional nuclear war happening. Right. Yeah, that sounds like that would be a concern too. Right. Or maybe a president being in control of being able to push the button and rather than it being an actual wartime thing, that there was a mistake in...
And I almost call that in the era of accidental. Mm-hmm. It's not intentional. But again, that's not really what I mean either. Not intentional, but that he made the wrong choice and he didn't do the preparation background for what are the repercussions.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. More like incompetence.
Right.
Okay. Well, is there anything else from the, I guess, from the Cold War perspective that you had any thoughts on? I remember, you know, at least in my short period of the military, that was during the Cold War too, and I remember we were just, we were constantly thinking about what the Soviet tactics would be. We were thinking about the type of weaponry they had, the type of response they might have, the type of soldiers they were putting together. Mm-hmm. We were thinking about that. Is that kind of similar, the type of things that you all were doing too? What kind of pilots they had, how good they were in the air, and
And again, it wasn't that I deployed to locations to counter that threat. It's just that I had friends and fellow units that did that, and I can tell how frustrated they became with constant alert for no good reason, except it turned out to be no good reason. Because the units were so busily trying to be prepared themselves that they just didn't have time, had the wherewithal to stay on alert all the time. And that's what they were being forced to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's talk a little bit about the golf business.
Okay.
I think on there I'd put one of the questions that in talking before, we had discussed how you got into the golf business. General Timberlake, when you were an aide for him, he loved to play golf, so you got out and were able to kind of get started.
Right.
But one of the questions I thought would be interesting to hear your thoughts on was how you managed to get to the level that you got to, which was you know, a very, very high level to win worldwide tournaments and, you know, service-wide tournaments. What interested you in getting to that level and how you managed to get there?
Well, I think the reason is that I wasn't very good, but they were worse. Yeah, that's how it happened. But see, this is the time that we were fighting the guys and the Goffin were fighting, and you had the Palmers and the Nicholases, mm-hmm. and those guys were so great, natural ability, and then they improved it to the point they were world beaters, and that gave you incentive to try hard and copy mm-hmm. and do that. And I was lucky enough to have occasion to play in and observe some of those guys in real life and doing their thing. And so I think the fact that I just had enough talent to make it work, and then mm-hmm. I had the interest because it was such a great game that I thought at the time, that it was so interesting, so thrilling for me to get involved and try to copy those folks.
I see.
I think that's probably mm-hmm. a good way to say it.
Well, certainly there were some opportunities in the service mm-hmm. when you were in there to actually compete on a very high level. Mm-hmm. And I've listed a couple of them down there, or actually pretty much from the beginning of your kind of your golf career on through. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to see if there's any comments as you look down this list, particularly that you might have any recollections on them. Of course, I'm going to, when I do the writing, I'm going to go into detail mm-hmm. a little bit more from the history of it, but from also the different articles and things that you were involved in. But I just wanted to get your thoughts, anything that you may remember about the tournaments, how you prepared okay. for them, and okay. the difficulty of facing competition at that level, some of the mm-hmm. things that you were thinking, and mm-hmm. how you managed to, you know, get yourself prepared mentally and you know, skill-wise for those type of things.
One is remember that I had to use caution because I didn't want the world to think that I play golf all the time. But it appears that way when you start looking at the things I've done in the golf business, that I was a golfer rather than a military guy. But it was just so happened that the Air Force provided me the opportunity to improve and compete at whatever level I wish. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably interesting to note. Mm-hmm. I think we should make that. And another thing that, and my wife can tell you better than I probably, how much preparation it took to get ready for these tournaments. I had to make a travel mm-hmm. and travel arrangement, but all the practice that went into preparation for each tournament, because they were around the world that I'd never seen the course before. It was like Johnny come lately to play a course that you didn't know mm-hmm. what the peculiarities of that course were, and that's what makes golf such an interesting game. You never see that shot twice in a row.
Mm-hmm. In preparing, did you look to see if there was anything available as far as information about the course, or did you just not know about it until you got there and actually got on board?
I think that was probably the secret. You didn't know about it until you arrived,
mm-hmm.
and then you crammed for. In each case, when I went to these tournaments, we had a practice round the day before, and that was not unusual. In mm-hmm. fact, it was the rule that we all were able to play the course at least one time before the tournament itself. And that's always a secret that mm-hmm. you can learn where the problems are, where the easier spots are.
Mm-hmm.
But that was that's what made it manageable. And then after you play that course that first time, then you know where to go back and practice the different kind of shots that you would incur on the course itself.
But you didn't have much time to practice, I guess.
Not really, no. It was normally the next day or maybe 2 days later.
Oh, I see. Round?
No, I'm right.
Did you play those tournaments, and I'm talking about the ones, the service tournaments, did you play those like the pros play it? Do you play four rounds?
Yes.
Okay.
Four rounds.
And they're day after day after day?
Yes, sir.
So once you finish the round, you've got that night and the next, when you start the next day to practice, which isn't much, I guess.
Right. Uh-huh.
You're making maybe a few hours practice at the most.
That's right.
You probably didn't want to practice too much because you've got to play. You have to compete.
That's correct, yes.
Oh, okay.
But the main thing in practice is you learn what shots not to hit.
I see. But basically every guy there competing is in the same boat.
Yes.
None of them have any advantage. They don't have, unless they've actually played the course before, they don't have the information ahead of time as to
that's
what.
That's right. And there was no ban against playing the course before. If you, mm-hmm. if you're in the military, playing a military course, if you go to that course in the time previous to the tournament, then you had every opportunity to learn more about it. So that's why we spent a lot of time on the road in order to get that inside view.
I see. Yeah. You're talking about on the road ahead of time.
Ahead of time.
Okay. Did you know, say like for instance, 1 year you would play one of these tournaments, and I'd refer to maybe the U.S. Air Force Worldwide Championship.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed on there you played that one 3 times. Is that played at different courses each time?
Yes, or? Different course each time. In fact, the inter-service competition 1 year would be hosted by the Army, and the next year by the Navy, and the next year by the Air Force, or vice versa.
Okay.
But yes, it'd be a different course each time.
And would you know ahead what course that would be?
You might only know it a few weeks, or maybe even it probably was known at the planning level, but the people themselves, the contestants, didn't really have access to the.
Mm.
I guess if you started doing research, really. But again, even if you knew which course you're playing, you wouldn't have the opportunity to run there and practice it well in advance.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't. Your boss wouldn't let you off to do that.
Yeah.
So you didn't gain a great deal by knowing that.
I see.
Unless you could get maybe a scorecard or a cheat sheet from somebody else who had played the course before.
I see.
So,
did you have caddies like you did in the pros?
Yeah, it was your option. I carried all the time, but most of us carried. But if you had, there was no caddies, not in the way the pros do it. No,
yeah.
You didn't
have the benefit of having a person who knew the course to tell
correct.
You what yardage and.
He might tell you between rounds of golf, but not between holes or shots.
I see. So you really. And when you say you carry, that means you're out there by yourself pretty
That's
much,
right,
you
yeah.
and your clubs.
Yeah.
That's a hard way to do it. Okay. Now later on, when you got into the PGA and you played the U.S. Senior Open and the different levels there, did you have caddies then?
Yes, we had caddies then.
At that point. And then, now were you required to have caddies?
No, not required, but it was an option, and most everybody had a caddy of a sort. I remember one of the early tournaments I played, not knowing what to expect, I had a caddy, and it was a young high school boy, and each day he came to caddy for me. And his mom had sent along a bag of goodies that we ate cookies and cake the whole round, all
that?
The way during the round.
How about that?
Yeah.
Did you play well based on that?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
So that worked good.
Yeah, I'll never forget that. Every day he'd have something different that his mother fixed for us.
That's nice. Did you find he was a pretty good caddy?
Oh, yeah, he was quite good. He
knew the course. And
He couldn't advise me on which shots to hit, but gave me the information about the course itself and the length and what's the trouble, where the trouble lay and where it did not lay.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's pretty good. That's helpful.
And I had a caddy at each one of the tournaments, that's the only one where I had a really good young boy to caddy for me.
Oh, I see.
But the rest of the time it'd be a lot of GIs that were taking time off from their work to caddy for mm-hmm. two reasons. One, to make a little money. And secondly, to have some time off.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Let's see. Let me just take a look here at some of the other... I think we've covered pretty much. This actual thing doesn't need to go into a lot of detail, this particular interview. It's just interesting to me, and I think it would be interesting to others who would eventually, you know, read this work. You know, just your personal observations, what it's like. Many of us, you know, have done very, very amateur golf rounds, but we always kind of wonder what it would be like to be up there, to step out on, you know, to the practice range and have all the people standing behind you, watching you, looking at you, maybe even asking you what your pointers are and that sort of thing. It's an intriguing thing to think about, you know, the professional level mm-hmm. and what that was like.
Yeah, it's almost frightening. In one sense, it's frightening, but then the other, it's very satisfying to show them what your talents are, mm-hmm. show them what the game of golf's all about. Yeah. And then it makes you feel good when the applause from the spectators if you hit a good shot. Mm-hmm. I remember one time, a long par four, a very difficult hole. I hit it in the fairway. I hit the second shot in the trap, in a big bunker in front of the trap, hit it out of the trap in the hole.
Oh.
And I'll never forget the noise that came from that shot. And then would you believe the very next hole was a par three, and I hit it about that far behind the hole and missed the putt.
Oh.
I'll never forget that, ever, ever.
Oh, that's pretty good. Can only fake it for so long, right?
That's right. Yeah.
That's pretty good. Well, let's see. Guess that's probably, unless there's something else you can think of as far as, you know, your preparations, your practice. Of course, you said it takes a lot of practice, and I'm sure you practiced everything that mm-hmm. you possibly could in preparation.
See, you practice off the sidewalk, because if the ball ends up on the sidewalk, mm-hmm. you either play it or you have a penalty, one or the other. So you try, even in this early stage, inexperienced stage, you start trying to hit every possible combination shot that you might come across in the play of that tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was it. I think, you know, and if the grass around the green is long, then you go over here in the corner somewhere and practice that kind of shot. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of practice. Not just hitting repeat the shots that we've been hitting, mm-hmm. but you try to work in the
just
unusual
new
kind
stuff
of shots,
and unusual but, things. That's kind of interesting. Did you have a particular part of the golf game that you really were extraordinarily good at that you didn't have to practice? Like, for instance, I think of it as your long game off the tee, your shorter game, and then your putting.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have anything there which you really, you know, like, you know, several of the pros you think of, they're great putters.
Yeah.
Or these guys are great. What would you say is your?
I think the short game around the green is okay. Where I excel. If excel is the right word, yes. I did spend a lot of time, but I could do that out of the front yard at home too, or out behind the garage, or out behind the fence between me and the neighbor. Mm-hmm. I bet Avis even sees me trying to hit them into the garbage barrel.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And even the girls. In fact, all three of them, and when we lived in Washington, D.C., there was this national park, the Mount Vernon Parkway, I guess, mm-hmm. probably. And there was an old fort down there that we used to go down and practice around it. Mm-hmm. I remember one time going to a soccer field, putting Mundine out in the middle of the soccer field, and I had shots to her.
How about that?
And just parenthetically, she used to take this bag, a little handbag with two little loops on it, to shag, and she'd pick up the ball. Well, mm-hmm. she'd start picking them up before they'd even hit the ground. And so I had to put a stop to that. Yeah, she was trying to get them in the, in the, in fact, she was trying to catch him in the bag, as I remember. Yeah, I remember that. And we'd do that almost, well, not every afternoon, but every weekend afternoon, we'd be practicing a good portion of the day. Mm-hmm. Remember that, eh?
Takes that kind of practice to stay at that level, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
Rebecca used to shag balls for you at the high school.
Oh, yeah.
There was a vacant lot next to the high school that was mowed.
Ah, okay.
I don't know what it was for, maybe.
Where was it? I forget.
At the high school. At
New Braunfels?
New Braunfels High School.
Not Mundina.
No, she's talking
Rebecca.
About
Rebecca. Rebecca.
Yeah.
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 How about that?
Rebecca used to shake. She could tell you about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. I don't think he ever paid them anything. They were supposed to be having fun.
Yeah.
And see, the thing is, it doesn't frustrate me necessarily, but I'm a little disappointed, I guess, in that none of the girls ever wanted to take up the game of golf and follow or learn to play. A little bit, but not really ever. Nobody ever took a liking to it. Yeah.
Well, I can say this. They do have fond memories of that, because at least Rebecca does, because she's mentioned it many times. Mm-hmm. Even though she didn't play, she liked being out there. Yeah. And she enjoyed the... Yeah. And I remember times where, you know, early on before we had kids, I would go out and play, and she would come along with me and just enjoyed, really enjoyed being out there on the course and everything. So that was good. Well, there's a question there too about some of your volunteer work, which I thought was really kind of interesting. The 108 hole marathon. So that's something worth, I think, going into in a little more detail if you don't mind.
Do that,
yeah.
Because this is, you know, you realize that this marathon is much different than a regular golf course marathon, because each hole on this golf course are much shorter. You wouldn't have many long holes, so it's much easier to walk 108 holes than it would be on a regulation golf course.
I see.
And you know, that's the fact that should be known. I don't want people to think that this is so unusual that you couldn't, nobody else could ever do it, and it's not that,
Well, the...
The picture of that's in the garage on the wall.
That's right, yeah.
And the scorecard, too, I believe. And see, I think I've said this before, but what I did... is when we planned it, we had people sign up to make to go out and seek donations, and so many cents or so many dollars per hole that I played. Then secondly, I'd ask you as a junior to play with me tomorrow morning at starting at 8 o'clock. No, make it 7 o'clock. We're going to get an early start. You play the first nine holes with me. Then I go to this junior and said, I'd like you to play the second nine hole with me starting at 7:45 tomorrow morning. And this guy or this gal, whomever, I want you to play the second time around. And so I'd have each one of us, and it would take our better ball.
I see, yeah. Well, obviously it was a fundraiser.
That's right.
And it was a fundraiser for the junior...
Junior golf.
Junior golf. And then, of course, and they're kind of earning their own money by playing with you.
That's right.
In a way. And how did the marathon work? You started and didn't stop. You played that many holes without stopping.
Continue stop.
And you had to stop at nighttime. Did it take you?
No, we played it in one day.
You did it all in one day.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
You start off early and stay played late, and we'd stop and have a snack of some sort. And in several cases, Mama sent food along.
Okay.
But we had our own little snack bar kind of thing, or we made a preparation for the food. I don't remember much detail, but it was... I'd normally have four or five people with us on each hole, each shot, be there to applaud or observe or ridicule us, maybe. For another case, maybe, And I just say this in passing... The boss was okay, but he's not much of a golfer, the guy who owned the property. But I'm sure he didn't think that I could make all the birdies that were being made. Because I was hitting, I really, really was playing well. And again, a short course, relatively simple. So I'd make numerous birdies. And he didn't believe it, so he'd come out to watch the play. Well, sure enough, I had two birdies in a row. He'd turn around and go back to the clubhouse. Then he'd hear stories about more birdies. He'd come back and watch it again.
Oh, I see.
And it was sort of like trying to ridicule me. I wasn't given the opportunity to. Anyway, that was a fun experience on my part.
I bet. I bet, yeah. Okay. Well, I think that that pretty much covers... I think that covers that particular...
But it was well attended and well done by the kids, too.
Mm-hmm. And you're able to raise almost $8,000.
Uh-huh.
That's amazing in one day.
And we turn around and put it back into the PGA's Junior Golf Program. So it didn't come back necessarily to our kids.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it was used for, to be honest with you, but it's to support Junior Golf.
Okay. Well, I had a thing on there too, retirement. How did that feel to retire from the golf business? I remember in the early days, at least when I first became associated with you, you worked long hours. You would be up before daylight at the golf course. This was at Landa Park down in New Braunfels. And it was before daylight, and then you'd get back sometimes after daylight, and then you would do club repair till nearly midnight and do it all over again.
Well, I think this is the plus for finding the job that you like to do. And so I found it very satisfying, and it was not really work. It was joy in a sense, even though I was gone from home and away from the family a great deal of the time. It was satisfying to do this job, and it was even satisfying to help somebody learn to play the game of golf. So I truly enjoyed my whole stay in the golf business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure you probably, once you did retire, obviously you missed it, but you probably had a lot of more time on your hands after that.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah. Yeah. See, I was thinking something while we were talking that I was going to make. Maybe I'll think of it in a moment.
Yeah. It was just it sounded like it was a love of the game that really kept you going all those years. And do you recall how many years you did wind up playing, maybe in the pro? 77, I think you.
Let's look from the time I got my first job in the golf business until I retired. Would have been, what is it? We'll let Avis look this. Where's the clips there?
I think you had
A?
Probably...
A, are you there?
I think she...
Sure, okay.
But basically, you retired from...
Military
in 77.
I went immediately into the golf business.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say in 77.
So maybe 20 years, right?
Yeah, at least that. And it was
maybe more than 20 years.
It was 02 when I left New Braunfels.
Okay, it's about 25 years.
I got out. Yeah, I've always counted 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out and went to work at Sundance. And even after I retired from Landa, after 22 years, I went out there for 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was a long, long, satisfying career.
Mm-hmm. And I think you find most of the people in the golf business have the same experience with their tenure as a golf professional. That they truly enjoy, and they just appreciate the opportunity to work with people and to demonstrate or show off or whatever that case may be. Yeah, I think that's probably true for almost all of them.
Well, that probably covers most of what we had for that particular session, but I think you mentioned that there was another one back here we didn't really cover too well. Maybe it was... which area we didn't cover. Do you remember which?
No, which not really.
Okay, well, we can cover it. We can hit those next time around if we need to. Well, thank you very much, Bill.
Yes, sir. Great.
Appreciate that interview.
Yes, sir.
That concludes.
Another byproduct. We've alluded in here several times that I've played in some of these tournaments, played with the big boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look back now with... a great deal of, not joy necessarily, but appreciation, or I'm not sure the right word, but pleasure that mm-hmm. I was able to observe those guys and watch what they do. I'll give mm-hmm. you an example. One example.
Okay.
I used to carry what little money I had in my pocket folded with a rubber band around it.
Mm-hmm.
And the old rubber band would get, and it'd be one of those wide bands,
mm-hmm.
and it would get dirty and sort of worn and sort of floppy and hanging around. But it was there. Okay, so one of those years I went to Florida to play in a tournament, the PGA Seniors in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And Palmer was in the same tournament. And it was the first year that he was in it because his age was different than mine, so they had to postpone the qualification date for this tournament so he'd be eligible to play in the tournament. Okay, that's
okay.
That's neither here nor there, but that's the case. And so when I got there, when I got to Florida to practice, and we were playing, and the second day we played, and in the PGA business, or in any big tournament play, we send people off of number 1 and 10 at the same time. Then you mm-hmm. switch. And then tomorrow, if you played 1 today, you start off number 10 tomorrow.
I got you.
Okay, so that's what we did. So the second day, I went off number 1, and Palmer went off number 10.
Mm-hmm.
And during the play of the tournament, you could hear noise across the golf course, and you knew that something big was happening. And we learned later that it was Palmer having a super brown, had shot a 64 that day on that golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And I may be shooting 74 or 71 or 2 mm-hmm. or 3 or 4. And so when we finished the round, I proceeded to take my clubs to my car and leave to go home and rest or read the paper mm-hmm. or eat breakfast or whatever. And Palmer is on the practice tee. We have to walk by on the way to the car.
Mm-hmm.
So he's on the practice tee, and his caddy is on the grass, on his knee, and they're hitting practice shots. Palmer had a habit.
Mm-hmm.
He's known for rewrapping his leather grips all the time. He's never satisfied with how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
So he unwraps it and rewraps it, makes it bigger or smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was doing. He just wasn't satisfied with a 64. And we never are. No matter how well you play, you're never satisfied. Mm-hmm. So he's doing that, and the caddy is taking care of the equipment for him and all. So he Palmer runs out of golf balls in the basket that he has on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So he stands there for a moment and wait. And I'm on my way to my car, so I stop at the driving range to watch him hit practice shots.
Mm-hmm.
And so he turns to his caddy and said, "I need some more caddy, John." No, I think his name was Jim. "Jim, mm-hmm. I need some more balls." And Jim just sits there. Said, "What do you need, some money?" "Yes, sir." So he reaches in and pulls out that wad of money, and it's got that old dirty, worn-out rubber band. And I thought to myself, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. That's the way I remembered. And so the Jim did, in fact, get up and go get some balls and came back and practiced off. And so that's how one golfer sees another golfer. He just appreciates giving the opportunity to watch this guy crank up a shot and see he's trying to hit a different shot in a different manner. Anyway, mm-hmm. that's one thing
that's
how
good.
we like to watch and observe other players. We mm-hmm. we root for and congratulate for and don't badmouth another golfer necessarily. Mm-hmm. We try to be gentlemanly about it, I guess is the right word. Anyway, mm-hmm. but I remember that rubber band forever. You remember that rubber band day?
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good story. Well, okay. Well, that's great. That's a good way to conclude this session. I appreciate that, and we'll talk to you next time.